Jesse, when your father brought some of the debris home for your family to look at, had that picture with General Ramey already been taken, that picture with your father that we've all have seen by now, or did that come afterwards?
That came afterwards because, again, what he was doing, he was on his way to the air base when he went by the house and showed the debris to my mother and myself. And after we brought the material to the air base base commander, Blanchard, to look at this, they decided this was something very unusual. So Colonel Blanchard dispatched my dad to Fort Worth, where General Ramey is located, to show Ramey the debris. And that's where the photographs were taken, in Ramey's office. So this is afterwards.
Okay, when you looked at what was put in the paper, did those items look the same to you, or did they look like they might have been switched?
Well, you know, I didn't see the pictures immediately. Actually, several years later that I learned of the photographs were taken in General Ramey's office. But I can tell you right now, that was not what was on our kitchen floor. And if you look at my dad's face, you know, when he's holding up a piece of this radar target, he's like, you got to be kidding me. You know, what is this all about? But they're trying to demonstrate that that was just a weather balloon. There is even a balloon envelope in the background there. So this is just parts of a radar target, a Rowan radar target.
Jesse, did he come home later on and say, doggone it, they're changing the story, or they've told me to say this? Anything like that?
Okay, yeah, what he did, when he came back home, and I'm not sure what was the next day or what time of this is, but when he came back, yeah, he sat my mother and myself down and says, look, don't ever talk about this. This is something that didn't happen. Just treat it as a non-event. And by golly, that's the way we treated it for many, many years afterwards. But he told me not to ever talk about this. And I think I remember seeing him in an interview one time where he said he was actually became part of the cover-up himself, but I'm not sure if that's whether that's accurate or not. But anyway, he just told us, don't talk about it.
Stanton, yeah. Do you believe he was frustrated as the years went by?
Well, I think he was, but I think you have to understand something here. Jesse was in the military. He fought in World War II, Jesse Sr. You follow orders, and that was standard practice.
Yes.
It would have been quite extraordinary if he hadn't followed orders. And all through this story, we have chain of command. Jesse Sr. was a major. He reported to Colonel Blanchard. Colonel Blanchard reported to General Ramey in Fort Worth, who was head of the 8th Air Force. He reported to General McMullen, who was temporary head of Strategic Air Command in Washington. Colonel DuBose, who worked for General Ramey, took the call from General McMullen telling him three things. And I got this directly from DuBose. Blanchard was dead, and McMullen was dead, and Ramey was dead, but DuBose was alive. I located him. And he was told, send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers. I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it, and I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. He doesn't argue about it. Colonel Marcel, who's on the program now, can tell you that, right, Jesse?
You betcha. You better believe it.
Jesse, as you were growing up in Roswell, did the story of the crash kind of filter around the people who lived there?
Well, you know, after this happened, there were a plethora of reports of strange things flying through the sky at that time. But, you know, it was summertime. I was having fun with my friends riding bicycles. And my dad told me not to talk about that, so I kind of put it in the back of my mind. Never forgetting about it, but I put it out of mind at that time.
So people were seeing UFOs or something in the skies way before the crashes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of newspaper accounts of strange things being seen in the sky. You know, and I guarantee they were not weather balloons.
Stanton, what would be in that area that would be of interest to extraterrestrials?
Well, I think you have to understand that New Mexico was a hotbed of advanced classified research and development. There are two nuclear weapons labs in New Mexico. That's why when Jesse went out, he was told to take a counterintelligence corps guy with him. And you knew Cabot, didn't you, Jesse?
Oh, yes. They're close friends with the family, Sheridan Cabot.
Yeah, he was counterintelligence, and he had a different chain of command than Jesse Marcel Sr. did, but there's no question that, remember, the first atomic bomb test was over at White Sands Missile Range. in 1945, July 16th. Incidentally, the press was told an ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately nobody was injured. They had plenty of experience at covering things up. So, you know, it's not surprising that visitors would be there. And, you know, consider the times. There were a lot of sightings. The first sighting that got a lot of attention, Kenneth Arnold's sighting, was up in Washington State. And Hanford Works are in Washington State, mm-hmm. where they were making plutonium. And
same year, wasn't it? Arnold was 47 also, wasn't he?
Just 2 weeks earlier, June 24th, yep. It hit the paper on June 25th. And this was less than 2 weeks after that. And there were 2,000 sightings in that period of time. July 4th weekend, hotbed of sightings all over the country. I mean, there was a little ridicule around one of the states where there weren't any sightings, 44 had sightings. One where there wasn't was Kansas, which, of course, was dry. That was what one of the newspaper articles said.
Can we assume that the objects that Kenneth Arnold saw, Stanton, that these might have been the objects involved in the crashes?
Well, we don't know. There were nine objects. He timed their passage from in front of one mountain to in front of another, knew the distance in between. It comes out between 1,200 and 1,500 miles an hour. The speed record at the time was like 675. First supersonic flight wasn't until October that year. Arnold's thought was, hey, the atom bomb was developed in secret. These are new government military craft. Didn't make it into World War II, but they're probably ours. They certainly were different from anything he ever knew anything about, and he was an experienced pilot.
I'm at the belief now, Stanton, that there's always a mothership and that these craft come down and they do their maneuvers within our atmosphere, but they're not the ones that come here.
Well, I agree with that entirely, yeah. And I've used the analogy that we have aircraft carriers, huge monsters that don't need to be refueled for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the Navy. He knows about them. And little small airplanes. Now, it would make sense because we have reports of huge objects in the sky, say half mile to a mile long. They're not the ones that crash or come down and land or whatever. They're way out there. But there's some excellent reports up in the Yukon, the Japan Airline case of 20 years ago. I mean, half a mile long? That's huge.
That's big.
But remember, the two different environments between the stars, where there's a lot of nothing. And then when you get near a planet, you got a lot of gravity, you got an atmosphere, you got to worry about heating and all kinds of things. And going the speed of light doesn't make a lot of sense around the planet. It only takes a seventh of a second to go around.
Jesse,
somebody for lunch at that velocity.
Did your father, from the moment he told you and your mother, we're not talking about this anymore, and we'll get to the deathbed discussions you had
okay.
the days before he died. But in between that, did he say anything about it over the years?
Well, you know, I guess the closest thing was, you know, staying at the supermarket checkout line. You know, you have these magazines that sensationalize UFO, or at least I was kidnapped to, brought to Venus, and this, that, and the other. And we kind of would look at each other and say, well, yeah, we know better than that. But that's basically all we talked about at that time.
I should throw in here that the man at the television station, I talked to him years later and asked what Jesse had told him about the case. And he said, look, we were ham buddies, and I asked him about it, and he said, I can't talk about that. And I mention that because I have people saying, oh, Jesse was talking all over the place, making up stories. That's malarkey. Jesse didn't tell this guy anything, but he remembered him, and those guys, ham radio buddies, have a good connection, right, Jess? You're still
Oh, yeah, they're real buddies there.
Jesse, what about people like Walter Haupt? Did you know him? He stayed in Roswell. If you did know him, what were your impressions of him?
Well, you know, Walter and his wife lived right down the block from us there at 1300 West 7th Street in Roswell. And I don't know if they're that close, you know, with my folks, but I'm sure I met Walter on many occasions back at that time. Because they just, like I say, they lived right just a few doors down from us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we asked Walter about Jesse Jr. way back, Bill Moore and I, years and years back in the 70s. And it was interesting that what he said, he was a bright young lad. That's what Walter said about Jesse
Jr. <nice. laughs>
He was right.
Yeah, sure he was.
Oh, he is a bright.
Of course.
But, You know, incidentally, Walter dropped the instrument package in one of the two nuclear weapons that were tested at Operation Crossroads in 1946 in the Pacific. And I mention that because one skeptic says, oh, he just made up the story. In the first place, the public information officer for the 509th would never make up a story without the boss's permission kind of thing. In the second place, he obviously had to be one of the best bombardiers around, or he wouldn't have been chosen for that job, because the test doesn't make any sense if you can't get instrument measurements.
Good point.
There's
now,
an awful lot of malignment of the people involved here by the nasty, noisy negativists.
Stanton, when did the debris go to Wright Patterson?
Well, the
Jesse, immediately?
Jesse didn't take it to Wright Pat. He stopped in Fort Worth, Texas.
Right, right.
We know that because of an FBI memo, that it was apparently the same day, July 8th, that a separate flight was sent up to Wright Field. Now, there's a standard technique in intelligence work, and Jesse Jr. can talk about that, where you break the chain so the guys at the beginning don't know where it winds up at the end. So Jesse Sr. didn't see the guys who got it up at Wright Field, and they didn't see the guys who brought it from Fort Worth, from Roswell to Fort Worth.
It's compartmentalization of information.
Yeah, standard practice.
What about the occupants, Jesse? Did your dad ever talk about the aliens?
You know,
we've heard so much about.
He never did discuss it with me. Although I guess he might very well. He was in a position to have seen them, but again, he never really discussed this finding with me.
Stanton, do we know if Jesse Marcel even saw the aliens?
He certainly never talked to me about it. It was interesting, though, that a man named Louis Rickett, and Jess, I think you knew him, too.
Yes, huh? Sure did.
He was another counterintelligence corps guy. He, in a conversation I had with him, said that there were certain things that weren't talked about, except under very special, you know, closed doors, cleared facilities, all that kind of thing. He was hinting at something like that, but he didn't flat out say anything about bodies. But it would seem they would have fallen in that class of information not to be discussed outside. But Jesse Sr. never, in that first television interview and stuff, never talked about bodies as far as I know.
Where did we get the information of the occupants? How did
well,
that come
it came
about?
From the crash over at the Plains of St. Augustine and Glenn Dennis's testimony. He was
okay.
A mortician in town who told about the nurse who told him that she got grabbed to help out with a dissection or an autopsy, I'm not sure which, at the base hospital. And we haven't been able to find that nurse, and Glenn is still alive, but not in good health, and I'm sure he won't be doing any interviews during the Roswell fiesta coming
right.
up, where Jesse and I will be probably doing lots of interviews. And, you know, I still haven't heard where you can get Jesse's book, because I know it's not at my bookstore here, and I'm anxious to see it. Jesse, you got copies available
if people
to the public?
Yeah, if people are interested, it's on MarcelJr.com. There's a display about the book there, or the RoswellLegacy.com. Those are the two websites that they can look at for information on the book. But I guess the best one would be MarcelJr.com.
Okay, we've got to get this out on Amazon, Jesse, because
yeah.
people will be searching for this like crazy.
That's great. Well, I think it'll be very interesting. It, like I said, it's a book that explains the feelings of the family toward the Roswell event and what it's done for us.
Jesse, what did this do to your father? Did you see any kind of personality change? I mean, if you really know, firsthand that we've been visited by extraterrestrials from another land, I mean, that would have a profound effect on us. Did you see a change?
Well, you know, I really wasn't around at that time because I was in the Navy and I was off at school and things like that, so I really didn't have any close personal contact with my dad during those years after that. But I do know one thing, that he must have been frustrated about something, because when we moved up here to Helena, we brought the cedar chest that had all his medals and decorations in it. When I went through that, they were all gone. So I think he must have gotten so frustrated he threw them away.
That's something.
That's too bad. But we could get them back, of course, as records, but the original medals are no longer present.
Did you, at what point did you begin to tell yourself now, because we're going to get into your story, that something was very unusual, something happened here that was out of this world?
Well, you know, not until after 1978, that's when my dad was starting to talk about it. And then people would come over to ask me about that because, of course, the namesake there. So I really didn't talk very much about it before then. But since my dad died in 86, that's when I've been catching a lot of flack also. And people have really been coming to me and say, well, what really happened? What's your opinion? What do you think was this, that, and the other?
And we should mention here that, Jess, you were involved in military aircraft accident investigations, too, weren't you?
Yeah, and, you know, as a flight surgeon, you do have a course in aircraft accident investigation, and you know, I've seen a number of aircraft accidents at various places here. So anyway, it's not unusual for me to, you know, at least I've seen aircraft accidents. I do know that the material seen in Roswell was not from that, though.
Stan,
that's my point. You were in a position to make a judgment about that, having been at accident.
You bet.
Did they find any craft intact at all, Stan, or were they all just simply obliterated?
Well, the one over in the plains of San Augustine apparently had a big crack in the side, and it was almost intact, would be a way to put it. The bodies were outside, and the government covered that one up, too, and wouldn't surprise me if there was a mid-air collision between the two. And I had one person say, hey, if one UFO is rare, how could you have two in the same place? And I should say that 40% of the 853 sightings reported in the UFO wave of 1947, a sort of book by a guy named Ted Blocher, 40% of the case involved more than one object seen at a time. And it's standard practice, and Jess can verify this, to send up a pilot and a wingman on missions. So if they ran into a radar beam, if they ran into a storm, whatever, in a mid-air collision, I asked a retired general who'd been a pilot and who had been base commander at Roswell in the mid-60s, General Exxon, I said, if you have a aircraft collision in the air, is the damage usually symmetric, that is the same in the two aircraft? He said no. Usually one will make it down barely and the other one tough luck. And that's what seems to have happened here. What Jesse saw, Jesse Sr., was debris spread out over this huge area. And one of the things he told me in our first conversation is there was no crater, which means there had to be a mid-air explosion.
Yes, it blew up.
Stuff over three-quarters of a mile
exactly.
long and hundreds of yards wide.
What are the possibilities that these were two different types of ETs and maybe they shot at each other?
Wow, now you're getting into science fiction. I have no idea.
Well, you know, I would like to add that. Yeah, one thing, you know, the debris that I saw looked like it came from the interior of something. You know, because there was nothing really structural material there. So this looked like it came from the inside, like it was blown through the side of the craft.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
An interior bulkhead or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have asked me, well, if this stuff is so strong and indestructible, you know, how come it was...
Save that, Stan. Save that when we come right back. We'll be back in a moment. Jesse Marcel, Jr., Stanton Friedman at Coast to Coast AM.